First, Pope Francis has been leading the Catholic Church for 5 years now. He followed more than 30 years of the John Paul II and Benedict XVI papacies, which were viewed inside the church and out as a long conservative period during a time of significant changes in modern culture. Depending on your point of view, those 10 years were in some ways a reaction or correction to the changes that Vatican II instituted in the mid-1960s, changes that liberals embraced and conservatives decried. Fast forward to 2013, and the former Jorge Mario Bergoglio of Argentina is elected pope and takes the name Francis as an homage to St. Francis of Assisi. Francis has been very popular with much of the non-Catholic world, especially the media, and with liberal Catholics who felt unheard during the previous two pontificates. But he has not lessened the divides within the church, and some would argue has made them even deeper. Russ Douthat is a columnist for the New York Times op-ed page. He's the author of several books, including Bad Religion, How We Became a Nation of Heretics. His most recent book is To Change the Church, Pope Francis and the Future of Catholicism. Russ, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
So I kind of, because I knew we have so much to get to, I kind of, you know, tried to give a little summary there leading up to the election of Francis. Can you set the stage for us, though, at the conclave of the College of Cardinals in 2013? What was the general mood after John Paul II's long tenure and then the historic retirement of Benedict?
Well, I think that there was a sense that what the Vatican needed above all at this particular moment was someone who could come in and clean house, not really in a sort of ideological or theological way, but in a very practical way. I think that there was a sense among the cardinals that you'd had these long pontificates where you had two very serious theologians who had sort of offered this, you know, particular interpretation of the Second Vatican Council and so on. And during that time, the Vatican itself had been mismanaged. It had sort of remained a kind of Renaissance court in the modern era. And I think the thinking in electing Jorge Bergoglio was that he was an outsider. He was someone who had a reputation for personal austerity as an archbishop and cardinal in Latin America. And he was also, you know, was and has become the first pope from outside Western Europe. And there was a sense of, you know, both sort of that as a historic thing, but also as a way to maybe take a little bit of power away from the sort of very Italian culture of the Vatican itself. So that was the thinking, and the funny thing about Bergoglio as Francis is that he's turned out to be a very different figure, I think, than most of the cardinals who elected him expected. Not all of them. There was a kind of block of more liberal cardinals, especially from Germany and other parts of Northern Europe, who I think hoped for or expected some of his liberalizing moves. But I think a lot of the people who voted for him thought they were voting for someone who would be focused like a laser beam on the Vatican's finances and these sort of internal issues. And instead, they've gotten someone who's a much more, I think, historically significant figure, for better or for worse, depending on your point of view, while the sort of Vatican reforms that he was elected to implement have sort of fallen by the wayside. So it's a classic case of, you know, you expect one thing from an election and you get something very unexpected in the end.
So what were some of the first indications of the direction Francis's papacy might take that were not perhaps what people expected?
Well, I think, first of all, people didn't expect his personality. They expected the austerity. You know, he was known for riding the subway instead of taking a private car and for visiting slums and, you know, some of which is sort of normal for an archbishop. But he had this particular reputation for sort of personal austerity. But he also was someone who never gave interviews to the media, who had a reputation as sort of dour and sour and so on as archbishop. And so the first surprise was that, you know, a lot of people who'd known him in Argentina watched him sort of interacting with the crowds and giving these long, famous press conferences in his airplane to journalists during his trips, and generally sort of having this kind of charisma that seemed to sort of come upon him with his ascension. So that was that sort of personal shift, the stuff that we think of as sort of his big media personality, his sort of gift for creating this kind of iconography around his papacy. That itself was a surprise. But then, you know, there were a few turning points. I mean, I think from the beginning of his pontificate, it was clear that, you know, he saw himself as something of a corrective to John Paul and Benedict, that, you know, the church had been focused on the culture wars of the West, and he wanted to sort of again, not surprisingly for someone from Latin America, talk more about sort of global poverty, ecology, the environment, and so on. And he had the sort of famously arresting phrase, who am I to judge if a gay person is seeking the Lord, and so on, which, again, were sort of technically consistent with prior church teaching, but had a very... there was that change, but then he sort of pushed even beyond that corrective in some of the stuff that my book is particularly concerned about, where he made, I think, unexpectedly to a lot of more conservative Catholics, this push to change church rules around communion for divorced and remarried Catholics in ways that set off this long and still ongoing battle within the church that's really sort of, you know, seems like it'll be remembered as one of the significant theological controversies of Catholic history, with cardinals arguing with the Pope and with each other, and so on. So that the divorce and remarriage issue was sort of the particular point where it became clear that he was after more than just a change of rhetoric.
So, Ross, you said that he is seen in some ways and might see himself in some ways as a corrective to Benedict and John Paul II, but he was actually appointed by John Paul, correct?
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, I mean, one thing to keep in mind, of course, you know, is that we use these categories, especially in the United States, as liberal and conservative and so on, to describe battles within the church. And they're fair up to a point, right? Like, on a certain set of issues, Pope Francis clearly is a liberalizer relative to his predecessors. But at the same time, there are ways in which they don't really fit, mm-hmm. right? I mean, John Paul II and Benedict both had views of economic policy that were, let's say, a bit to the left of the American Republican Party, right? I mean,
right.
You know, if you looked at Benedict the 16th statements on the environment, you would have said, well, he's not a sort of American style conservative at all. And John Paul, you know, I mean, I think both of them, while they were theologically conservative, they were both conscious that they were governing a very divided church, a church in which, that has incredible variation within it. Like, the difference between sort of the moral and theological climate in the Netherlands versus in Kenya, or, you know, in Brazil versus in Berkeley, California, or something. I mean, this is a church that has to straddle all of these different divides. And so their appointments were, you know, they leaned conservative, as Archbishop Bergoglio was seen as more conservative than he's a member of the Jesuit order, which has a more liberal reputation. He was seen as more conservative than some. But at the same time, it isn't that surprising that you would still get archbishops and cardinals within the church who differed from Benedict and John Paul on specific issues, had a different vision, and so on. But still, even with that being said, people were quite surprised at how far someone elected by cardinals appointed by the last two popes has been willing to push and go in seeming to break with some of their sort of teachings.
It kind of reminds me of U.S. Supreme Court justices who go in a different direction than they might have been
expected. Well, no, there is an element of that you don't know how the office will affect the person, right? There's this sort of, and how the, you know, and also, I mean, for Francis, right, I think, you know, Francis is, he sort of sides with the church's liberals on certain issues without being, you know, he's not a secularizing figure at all. He talks about the importance of devotion and mysticism, and, you know, he has a very sort of intense piety. So he's sort of traditionalist in certain ways, but then on other issues he's more liberal. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's happened is he pushed for these changes and met conservative resistance. And my sense of things is that because conservatives resisted him, he became more critical of conservatives, that there's a sense in which, you know, who takes your side determines which direction you go in certain ways, at least for a little while.
We're talking with Ross Douthat. He's a columnist for the New York Times op-ed page, and we're discussing his most recent book, which is To Change the Church, Pope Francis and the Future of Catholicism. And Ross, in your book, you talk a lot about the difference between how non-Catholics, especially the secular press, see Francis compared to his two immediate predecessors. How would you summarize that difference?
I mean, the simplest way is to say, you know, that he's the cool pope, right? And John Paul II had a little bit of this, too. I mean, he was a very charismatic figure, and especially early in his reign when he was confronting communism in Poland and traveling the world and seemed sort of young and charismatic, he got a lot of favorable press as well. But you had this period where John Paul got old, and, you know, the church sort of lost a lot of culture war battles in the West, with same-sex marriage being sort of the obvious example. And then you had the sex abuse crisis, and then you had Benedict, who had this somewhat unfair but real reputation as this sort of tough doctrinal enforcer. And his pontificate was something of a mess because the Vatican was misgoverned. So you had this long period where the press, I think, became accustomed to a critical, adversarial view of the Vatican as this world out of step and so on. And then Francis comes in, and people, I think, fell in love with the narrative of contrasts, right? The idea that, you know, that you'd had bad conservative popes, or, you know, stern conservative popes, and now you had this guy who was taking selfies with, you know, with mm-hmm. people, and was sort of, as he has done, sort of loosened up the church's public teaching in various ways. And I think it's very natural for, it's natural in certain ways, right, for the media to fall in love with that. But it's also surprising in certain ways because the press is such a secular enterprise. I don't think my colleagues would really mm-hmm. dispute. I'm probably a bit more religious than the average journalist. And so it's interesting that someone who is, you know, that someone who is not just a religious figure, but the leader of this ancient church and so on, could inspire so much interest. It shows both, I think, that the secular press was eager to tell a story about a liberalizing pope, but also that even the most secular and jaded reporter has a certain amount of interest in Christianity and religion after all.
We're talking with Ross Douthat about his most recent book titled To Change the Church, Pope Francis and the Future of Catholicism. He's a columnist for the New York Times op-ed page and the author of several books, including Bad Religion, How We Became a Nation of Heretics. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you're Catholic, how would you rate Pope Francis's first 5 years in office? Are there issues that you particularly agree or disagree with him on? And if you're not Catholic, what's your view of him from the outside? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up that conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Right now, we're continuing the conversation with Ross Douthat about the first 5 years of Pope Francis's papacy. Ross's most recent book is titled To Change the Church, Pope Francis and the Future of Catholicism. And you can tell us what you think at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of Pope Francis? Why or why not? If you're Catholic, do you think he's good for the church, or are matters of faith and policy swinging too far to the left? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And we did have a few comments on Facebook. Pam says she loves our Pope. She thinks he is very Christ-like. He's gentle and kind and truly cares about the poor and the displaced. He's certainly not perfect, she says, but he is a most genuine person. And Jenny says she no longer considers herself Catholic, but absolutely loves this Pope. He's very much in touch with the people, unlike his predecessors. He has common sense and a sense of humor. And Ross, both of those kind of sum up that popular image and perception that we've been talking about.
Yeah, I think they do. I mean, I think there's no question that Francis has changed perceptions of the papacy in ways that, again, I think would not have seemed necessarily possible in such a short time for an institution buffeted by scandal and so on. And the biggest way he's done it, I think, is through sort of the iconography of the papacy, these images of him washing the feet of prisoners, embracing the disfigured man with boils on his face, and so on. And again, the reality is that prior popes have also done things like that. Benedict XVI visited prisons as well. So there is, some of this is, you know, again, this sort of media narrative wanting, you know, an interesting story of this, you know, different, radically different pope. But at the same time, Francis has leaned into it in ways that, from a kind of image management perspective, have been very effective.
Let's look inside the church and inside the Vatican. The view isn't as rosy as it seems kind of from the outside, from that image of Francis. You say that many divides within the church have actually grown deeper, despite hopes that Francis could bridge them. And you said that as conservatives have pushed against him, he has then pushed against them. What are some of the key topics that those deepening divides are visible on?
I think the basic issue, right, is that, you know, since the sexual revolution, since the 1960s and 70s, there is just this clear tension between the kind of absolutes of Catholic, what you might call New Testament sexual morality, the Catholic vision of marriage and family and, you know, the no's to premarital sex and same-sex marriage and so on, all of which, you know, are not inventions of the popes. They go back as much as concern for the poor does to the words of Jesus in the Gospels. Jesus takes a very hard line on questions of sexual purity and marriage and so on. So you have those teachings, and then you have the way we live now, right, mm-hmm. which is a bit different. And I think and then you have the fact that Catholicism is committed to the idea that popes can't actually change church teaching, that the papacy has all of these powers, but actually it's very limited because it's just supposed to hand the truth on unchanged. And so Francis and people around him especially are looking for ways to basically say, well, we've got doctrine up here somewhere, sort of, you know, on a shelf in the abstract, but then we have pastoral practice, and we can basically create all kinds of exceptions on all of these issues, starting with divorce and remarriage, but applying to a range of other issues, bioethics, euthanasia, and so on, that enable us to kind of finesse that difference between where the church is and where the culture is. And what conservatives are more likely to say, and I should say that I'm one of them, the book is, it tries to tell the story of Francis, but it's skeptical, I think, of this as well, is that, you know, the church has compromised already in various ways on these issues. And the problem with sort of putting doctrine on a shelf is that at a certain point, people don't really think it's something you actually believe in anymore. And you get into a kind of late Soviet dynamic where, you know, oh, officially we're still saying this, but really we're sort of abandoning the teachings. And that has sort of been done in a lot of mainline Protestant denominations, and it hasn't seemed to bring people back to church in the end. It's basically just sort of created internal civil wars and a kind of crisis of credibility for those denominations. And the truth is, again, conservatives also look at the Western world right now, you know, right down to the, you know, the Me Too moment we're all going through. We're aware of how badly men especially have sexually misbehaved, and conservatives look at that and say, well, you know, this culture seems to be in kind of a mess on the matter sexual, and it's not clear that, you know, if the Catholic Church is the last institution in the Western world that's saying in some muted way that divorce is a bad thing and, you know, marriage is central and so on, maybe now is not the right time for the church to sort of be seen as surrendering. And that's, I think, the danger of the Francis era is that that's how it's seen by people. They're saying, oh, we like Francis because, you know, he's changing the church and bringing it up to speed with the times, but I'm not actually going to go back to church. I'll just think a little better of Catholicism. And that is a reputation for its own kind of decline, I think.
And we're getting a little short on time, Ross, and I wanted to read a Facebook comment from Kristen, because she said she feels he has brought more people back to Catholicism. Many stopped attending Mass or joined other churches after the pedophile scandals. He's bringing people together. She says the church is not perfect, but it's better than it has been. But in reading your book, it seems like there's that thought out there, but there's not necessarily the data to back it up.
No, there isn't. And I mean, look, I certainly know people who have been brought back to church by Francis. I don't want to dispute anybody's anecdotal experience. But if you look at overall trends, what we call the Francis effect is mostly a media phenomenon. It's a result of people, you know, expressing favorability towards the Pope, covering the Pope, being interested in the Pope. But for instance, you know, the latest Gallup data, polling data on mass attendance in the U.S. shows a decline, actually a steeper decline under Francis than before. And I think the challenge, you know, this is not Francis's fault per se. There are deep structural reasons why institutional religion is in decline in the West. But I think there's this sort of too easy assumption that, well, if you liberalize the church, it will bring lots of people back to Mass. And in fact, the reasons people have drifted away from their churches are much more complicated than just disagreeing with what the church says about divorce. And it's hard to, and liberalization, again, it creates these internal divisions, these divisions between different parts of Catholicism that can cost as much as they can gain.
So, Ross, there were moves towards liberalism that came out of Vatican II. Then there were the more than 30 years of conservative correction, perhaps we can call it, under John Paul II and Benedict. And now we have Francis for as long as his papacy lasts. What do you see coming next? It seems like there have been swings pretty far in either direction. What do you see as following this?
I mean, if you're just analyzing it in sort of the simplest grounds, you would say, look, Francis is appointing bishops and he's appointing the cardinals who will elect his replacement. Therefore, you should expect the Francis agenda to continue. And that's completely plausible in certain ways. At the same time, before Francis was elected, nobody was predicting liberalization. There are a lot of people, cardinals especially in the church, who might feel that you want a swing backwards, that it's sort of a pendulum you're constantly trying to correct. And there is this other dynamic, which is that younger priests tend, because they became priests under John Paul and Benedict when it was this sort of very countercultural thing to do, they're more likely to be more conservative. So you have this fascinating generational dynamic of older liberals and younger conservatives, in many cases, in the hierarchy of Catholicism. And how that plays out is itself a sort of, it's a mysterious question. And, basically God has a lot of surprises in store for the Catholic Church, no matter what.
Well, Ross, thanks so much for joining us today. Very interesting conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Ross Douthat is a columnist for the New York Times op-ed page. He's the author of several books, including Bad Religion, How We Became a Nation of Heretics. He joined us to talk about his most recent book, To Change the Church, Pope Francis and the Future of Catholicism. And you can keep the conversation going over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know what you think.